the Capital Investment Committee for March 2nd is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed by House Public Information Office. Mr. Lencheski, please take the roll.
Representative Thule.
Lee, present.
Representative Thule, present. Representative Mary Murphy.
Present.
Representative Mary Murphy, present. Representative Dean Erdahl.
Present.
Representative Dean Erdahl, present. Representative Esther Abaje. Representative Kayla Berg. Representative Greg Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Greg Davids, present. Representative Keith Franke. Representative Keith Franke, present. Representative Mike Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Mike Freiberg, present. Representative Rick Hansen.
Rick Hansen, present.
Representative Rick Hansen, present. Representative John Hewitt.
Present.
Representative John Hewitt, present. Representative Leon Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Leon Lilly, present. Representative Eric Lucero.
Very happy. It is not my birthday today.
Representative Eric Lucero, present. Representative Rena Moran.
Present.
Representative Rena Moran, present. Representative Nels Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Nels Pearson, present. Representative Donald Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Donald Raleigh, present. Representative Jordan Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Jordan Rasmussen, present. Representative Liz Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Representative Liz Ryer, present. Representative Nolan West. Representative Jay Zhang.
Here.
Representative Jay Zhang, present. Representative Esther Abaje. Representative Kayla Berg. Representative Kayla Berg.
Berg, present.
Representative Kayla Berg, present. Representative Nolan West. Members, with the conclusion of the roll call, please mute your devices. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Lencheski. Members, a quorum is present. Please note any of the members that are missing from quorum as they come in. Representative Murphy, do I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 25th?
Mr. Chairman, I move the approval of the minutes for February 25th as printed.
Vice Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for February 25th. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 25th are approved. Members, today, MMB Commissioner Jim Showalter is on hand to provide an overview of the governor's 2021 bonding recommendations that were announced last week. The bonding bill language is not yet available, but we will get details from Commissioner Showalter and other agency commissioners and staff as needed. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Showalter. Please identify yourself and begin with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Lee. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, and today I'm presenting the Governor's 21 capital budget, the Local Jobs and Projects Plan. And joining with me, as you mentioned, are a number of colleagues from commissioners from state agencies, leaders from organizations that are included in this budget. This is my first time testifying before your committee, and I really appreciate being here today. I see the slide is already up, which is awesome, because what we're going to do is we start by recognizing where we started from, which was the 2020 bonding bill. And I just want to thank members for your work in passing that, which makes investments across the state in many areas that are important to Minnesotans, from transportation to water infrastructure. Following that comprehensive bill that was just passed in October, Governor Waltz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan put together this plan, which is really more of a focused capital budget for 2021, that off year, that addresses some critical needs and time-sensitive opportunities. There's basically three elements to this project, to this plan. One is a critical need for maintaining and investing what we already have. If you look at deferred maintenance, and I know this committee has heard this issue before, and I think you're really well familiar with it, the backlog that we face is really significant. For state agencies, the deferred maintenance total is about $1.7 billion. For higher education and their state-supported buildings, Minnesota State's deferred maintenance is about $1.1 billion. And the University of Minnesota's deferred maintenance total is about $2.15 billion. We're at a critical point where the average age of our 4,854 state agency buildings is like 40 years old. And about 80% are in crisis, poor, or just fair condition. You know, we need to preserve and maintain these assets. And it's a really a fiscally responsible position, because not doing so is going to cost us even more money down the line. So that approach for asset preservation is really core to what you're seeing here. And it is really to look at what was left unfunded in that 2020 bill and lift them up in this off year. So when you combine the 2020 bonding bill with the 2021 governor's rec, those underfunded asset preservation programs are raised to about 76% of the governor's previous total recommendation. The second critical need that you'll see in this package is investing in our communities. This means addressing the inadequate housing supply, helping our neighbors in Minneapolis and St. Paul rebuild their businesses, ensuring that there's room in every bonding bill for equity, and include access to for community-based organizations that have traditionally not had access to capital investment from the state. And finally, the third piece of this project and proposal is looking at time-sensitive opportunities before us in the 21 session. Now, these are projects that ensure that federal funds come to Minnesota, and it's a high bar. Only projects that have a state match needed in the right away are in the 21 bonding bill. We'll walk through those projects later in the presentation, but I'll note these are selected because we want to avoid losing federal dollars going to another state. There's also the opportunity of just the timing of the bill. We're in a low interest rate environment, a great shovel-ready projects, tailored bonding bill that's something we can fit into the state budget. So I'm going to go to the third slide. The question has come up both in the initial governor's budget recommendations when we released these bonding packages, like, why bond now? You know, how much can we, is this too big, too small, is it just right? You know, I think the bottom line here is we can afford to make these investments today. As I said before, you know, we're in a low interest rate environment. You know, we just recently completed the sale of about $1.2 billion in general obligation bonds. And the interest rates that were paid were historically low, ranging from about 1.26% to about 1.6% on new 20-year debt. Combined with that, you know, the state continues to have high, strong ratings. We're AAA in two of the bond houses, and that helps us keep their interest rates payments low. Also, just note that, you know, what we're really is following historic norms of how much we're putting into the budget, and that we've got now a continued stronger position for this upcoming biennium. And as I noted before, every year these projects get more expensive. We kick the can down the road, the project costs will increase, that the building conditions will get worse, the cost of inputs will get higher. All of these things mean that waiting is actually not the way to go. I want to note that Standard & Poor's, one of the rating agencies, stated that significant underspending in maintenance can reduce asset life and increase capital costs, pressuring a government's future flexibility. You know, so there's a lot of reasons for approaching this, that's why you see the focused bonding bill in front of you, to take care of investments, to take care of critical needs, to respond to them in a timely manner. Another question that frequently comes up is, well, how does this fit within our debt capacity guidelines? Do we have the money to pay for it? On the next slide, I just want to remind folks about the debt capacity guidelines that have been set up for the state. They guide our capital investment decisions. They're part of the way that we compare ourselves to other states and take a look at, different ways of measuring how much indebtedness we have. The first two measure existing authorized debt against state personal income, and the third measures how quickly the state pays down its debt. You can see the threshold compared to where we're at now in FY21 with figures from the February forecast for each of the guidelines. We have previously presented this to the committee, and the legislature could pass a $3.3 billion investment package and still remain within these guidelines. Our package is much more modest, a total funding level of $518 million. So we have enough capacity under these guidelines to support the governor and the lieutenant governor's capital budget recommendations while preserving the ability to authorize more debt in the future. Slide 5 shows you the governor and lieutenant governor's 2021 local jobs and projects plan just by scale. This pie chart just shows you how the $518 million in asks spreads across priorities. About 46% is to maintain existing assets, 51% is for investing in communities, about 3% is state match to ensure that federal funds come to Minnesota, and less than 1% are for other purposes such as bond sale expenses. So what we're going to do is walk through the projects that make up each spending category in the following slides. If it's okay, Chair Lee, as you mentioned, I mentioned, we've got a number of experts and leaders here, commissioners from various agencies, and we're going to walk through them because they're closest to these projects and can address the importance of these asset preservation asks.
Thank you, Commissioner, and for members, we are going to break it down by the different issue areas. And so if you have any specific questions for the next set of slides, feel free to raise your hand and we can take them as we go along. And so the first one would be HEPR, probation bonds for administration, DNR, and capital security complex. And why don't we start out with Mike Bertelsen from the University of Minnesota. Please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Mike Bertelsen. I'm the Vice President for University Services at the University of Minnesota. Thank you to the Governor for his recommendation to the legislature for your past support of HEPR and the University of Minnesota. HEPR is the university's number one capital priority. The University of Minnesota has a significant facility footprint across the state of Minnesota with nearly 30 million square feet of space across our system. We have quite literally a presence in every county in the state of Minnesota. Our facilities, however, are aging and many are in critical need of renewal to help them keep them safe, productive, and welcoming. In fact, over half of our facilities are over 50 years old. And 8.7 million square feet of space across our system is in poor or critical condition, a number that has risen significantly over the past 7 years. Facility renewal, therefore, is a recurring, consistent, and predictable problem and growing. The $56.9 million proposed by the governor would allow us to address some of the most critical needs in our $200 million HEPR request. A few examples are highlighted on the slide. The committee has our full $200 million list of HEPR requests, but we've also prepared a list of projects that would be funded under the governor's proposal that can be made available after the presentation. We allocate HEPR dollars across all campuses according to a straightforward and equitable formula based on how much space each campus has and what condition that space is in. Lastly, I'd like to say that the university is ready and able to spend as much money as you can allocate to us. We routinely have hundreds of millions of dollars of construction projects in process. This past year, we were managing nearly 350 ongoing projects in some stage of feasibility, design, or construction. For our most likely list of $56.9 million of HEPR projects, we estimate that in less than 6 months, 73% of those projects would be designed and ready to bid, and the remaining 27% would be designed and ready to bid in less than 12 months. We are confident that we can maintain a high level of performance at any conceivable level of appropriation. We do this through streamlined central processes, best value procurement systems, and use of a very experienced in-house design and construction project managers that understand the unique needs of higher education and the kind of complex buildings that the university requires. Simply put, investing in the University of Minnesota infrastructure is a proven and unique stimulus opportunity for our state and will put Minnesotans back to work. Thank you very much for your your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bertelsen. Next up, we have Brian Yolitz from Minnesota State. Please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Lee and committee. My name is Brian Yolitz, and I serve the 37 State Colleges and Universities of Minnesota State as Associate Vice Chancellor of Facilities. It's too good to be with you again. It seems like we were Zooming together just a couple weeks ago. I'm here on behalf of our Board of Trustees and Chancellor Malhotra to share Minnesota State's eager support for the governor's focus on asset preservation of the state's owned buildings and this recommendation for the HEPR funding for Minnesota State campuses. Our campus buildings represent the doorway to higher education and a better life for so many Minnesotans. These buildings need to be welcoming and offer teaching and learning environments that are warm, safe, and dry, and operate efficiently. Right now, many simply don't do that. You may recall 2/3 of our academic buildings were built nearly 50 years ago in the early 1970s and earlier, and they, along with their systems, are increasingly in need of preservation, modernization, and replacement. While there has been some asset preservation investment in recent years in these buildings, it has just not kept up, and many of these buildings and their components have gone untouched. HEPR funding offered in today's recommendation will go a long way in assessing the number one capital investment priority of our campuses by repairing and replacing outdated roofs, heating and cooling and ventilation systems, doors and windows, utilities like plumbing and electrical systems, and safety issues, including hazardous waste hazardous material abatement, emergency generators and switchgear, fire suppression systems, elevators, and security equipment. Again, we are very grateful for the governor's support of asset preservation and HEPR funding for Minnesota State's campus buildings and the top priority of our college and university leaders, and we encourage your support. Chair Lee and committee, I'd like to now turn to Wayne Wislowski, a colleague from the Department of Administration. Wayne?
All right, Mr. Wislowski, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, it's Wayne Wislowski. I'm Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. Governor recommends $74.9 million of general obligation bonds for state agency asset preservation. Asset preservation has become an increasingly important challenge for state agency operations. Adequately maintaining state facilities is imperative to support the efficient and effective delivery of services and programs to our customers, the people of Minnesota. Asset preservation funding provides improved safety and better government while protecting state investments in the following ways. First up is property stewardship. Funding asset preservation ensures that staff, the public, and custodial individuals are kept safe and that functional needs are optimally met. Fiscal stability. Timely planned preventative maintenance reduces total cost of ownership, eventually freeing up resources for core program functions. It's cheaper to maintain than fix, addressing some of the backlog and remaining current on repairs is efficient budgeting because it costs more to fix breaks and respond to urgencies than to fund planned prevention. Funding asset preservation requests saves energy and reduces greenhouse gases. Modern, properly operating buildings help meet the state's sustainability goals by conserving energy and water and reducing waste. As Commissioner Showalter mentioned, deferred maintenance is a significant issue for state agencies. To help illustrate the critical need to fund agency asset preservation requests, please consider the following information on the state's deferred maintenance. These numbers are from the 2020 Facility Condition Assessment Report. This condition assessment is performed annually by state agencies in a standardized way. State of Minnesota owns 4,800 buildings spread across 19 state agencies. This adds up to more than 33 million square feet of space. And that excludes the Department of Military Affairs, federally funded 1,200 buildings that they manage and oversee. These buildings have a replacement value of over $9 billion. The average age of these buildings is 40 years old, as Commissioner Showalter mentioned, with 42% of buildings over the age of 40. The deferred maintenance on these buildings is estimated to cost $1.7 billion. Recent asset preservation funds have been used for replacing and repairing HVAC systems and water heaters. updating building control and security systems, replacing elevators and windows, and replacing and repairing building roofs. I want to highlight a couple of the agency asked for renovation requests in the governor's recommendations. First, the Department of Human Services. Their asset preservation request is essential to support the operations of their residential treatment facilities and community-based program operations. DHS requests involves the repair, replacement, and renewal needs specific to the operations of direct care and treatment facilities. These needs developed over time and represent a system-wide asset assessment of known facility deficiencies, including but not limited to security, safety, and code compliance issues, life and fire safety deficiencies, such as fire sprinkling, detection, and alarm systems, major mechanical and electrical utility systems, repairs, replacements, upgrades, and improvements, abatement of hazardous materials like asbestos and lead paint, roof replacement or repair of structural deficiencies, and tuck pointing and other building envelope work. Next, the Department of Corrections. DOC facilities operate 24/7 and have ongoing asset preservation needs. DOC's asset preservation requests will go towards critical projects such as replacing the high power voltage lines at Stillwater that pose a life safety risk to corrections staff and those incarcerated. The facility has experienced fires due to line failures. Now I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Strawman to highlight some of DNR's asset preservation projects.
Thank you, and welcome, Commissioner Strawman. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name for the record is Sarah Strawman, and I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I think we all know that natural resources and outdoor recreation are very important to Minnesotans, and we've seen over this past year that importance perhaps more than ever as Minnesotans turn to the outdoors in record numbers for their physical and mental well-being. DNR offers these high-quality opportunities to recreate throughout the state, and we want to make sure that we can continue to offer these opportunities and also make sure our state-owned facilities are safe places for employees to work and the public to visit. Our deferred maintenance need is too large to address at once, and you've heard about the state's overall deferred maintenance backlog. So we've developed a 10-year approach, and I believe the committee has our report taking care of what we have, so you can refer to that for more information on how we do that 10-year approach. The 2020 bonding bill was important to the DNR for the asset preservation dollars it did provide. However, it was far below what was needed to make measured progress in taking care of what we have. DNR's capital assets are unique because they are extensive. They are diverse. It's not just buildings, but it's roads, trails, culverts, wastewater treatment systems, et cetera. And they're geographically dispersed. We have a presence in all 87 counties. So there's still work to be done if we're going to continue to offer outdoor opportunities that Minnesotans expect and deserve. Our top priority for capital assets is taking care of the $3 billion of capital assets we have by preserving and, when needed, replacing existing facilities. The DNR alone manages over 2,800 buildings, of which nearly one in three is over 50 years old. One in four is in unacceptable or poor condition, and only one in four meet today's design and building standards. These built assets are critical to support DNR operations, services, and programs. The governor's recommendation of $33.43 million for natural resource asset preservation will bolster last year's appropriation of $20 million and allow us to address needs such as HVAC system repair, leaking roofs, building code violations, removing life safety hazards, road, trail, and bridge repairs, potable water and wastewater treatment systems, as well as crisis and poor building components. In the category of betterment of buildings, and this is the category that provides new construction where needed, as opposed to taking care of existing buildings, we know that DNR's buildings must be safe, ADA accessible, energy efficient, et cetera. The governor's recommendation of $19 million for betterment of buildings would enable the DNR to make significant improvements to meet these goals. In this funding category, our priorities include additional space at the Hibbing Drill Corps Library, consolidated offices, state park shower buildings, fish hatcheries, and storage facilities in order to bring them up to current standards and ensure workplaces and public spaces are safe and accessible. Again, our goal is to bring all capital assets up to good or better condition within 10 years, and the governor's bonding recommendation makes significant progress toward catching up with deferred maintenance, resulting in better service to the public. And Mr. Chair, I think I'm handing it back to the Department of Administration. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Stroman. Next up, we have Chris Given from Department of Administration.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chris Given, and I'm the Director of the Facilities Management Division in the Department of Administration. We operate and maintain the facilities on the Capitol complex. As part of that responsibility, we provide facility maintenance and support to the Department of Public Safety's Capitol Security Division to facilitate their efforts with maintaining security on the Capitol complex. The governor's 2021 capital budget contains a request for us to continue the physical security enhancement work that has been underway since 2018 under the advisement of the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security. The committee was created statutorily in 2012. Its purpose is to assess and advise the legislature on security issues and recommend security improvements as necessary. The committee is chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. Membership is composed of the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court and members from both houses of the legislature and from each political party within them. It also consists of advisors from the legislative, judicial, and executive branches of state government, as well as those from the corporate and educational sectors of our society. Based on our most recent security assessments, threats to the Capitol complex range from opportunistic criminal activity to well-planned extremist attacks. Consequently, in 2012, the committee commissioned a consultant to conduct a study and pre-design to mitigate the vulnerabilities caused by these threats. Previous security studies completed for the Capitol complex focused on operational security vulnerabilities. This study and follow-on pre-design were different in that they addressed the physical vulnerabilities of the buildings. They were conducted by architects, engineers, and security professionals. They focus on structural, landform, and architectural elements of the facilities. The study and pre-design identified many vulnerabilities on the Capitol complex. Each of them is assigned a risk level and a priority. The risk level is based on the potential loss of life, assets, and impacts to government operations. The priority is based on the urgency of the need to eliminate the vulnerability. To reduce these vulnerabilities, our consultants recommend the following types of security upgrades: installation of bollards, which are posts and other objects to keep vehicles from approaching a facility; installation of projectile-resistant glass in select locations on our buildings to help mitigate the effects of flying shattered glass that would result from bomb blasts; installation of additional card readers to secure non-public areas of our buildings; construction of security kiosks in those facilities which don't have them; incorporation of utility protection features to guard exposed utility infrastructure; installation of entry controls on parking facilities adjacent to buildings; installation of additional emergency call stations throughout the complex; securing our vulnerable building air intakes to limit exposure to hazardous materials and explosives; and similarly, providing window well protection for those windows on the complex that are below grade. In 2018, the Department of Administration received $10 million of the $33.5 million needed back then to complete this work. The work funded as part of the 2018 bonding bill is nearing completion, but it represents only 35% of the total physical security need and thus leaves over half of the Capitol complex population and building square footage without programmed physical security improvements. Therefore, the governor's 2021 capital budget includes, and the Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security recommends, $31 million in general obligation bonds and $12 million from the general fund to continue the work of the security upgrades and to incorporate additional security enhancements for crowd control and vandalism protection, as will be identified by the upcoming security threat assessment on the Capitol Mall and areas around adjacent buildings. These actions are necessary to improve safety and security for those who work and visit the Capitol complex. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this concludes my statement. I will stand by for your questions at the end of the presentation. I'd like to pass it on to Commissioner Ho of Minnesota Housing.
Thank you, Mr. Given. Before we move on to Commissioner Ho and the rest of the presentation, we'll take up some questions on HEPR and asset preservation. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Commissioner Showalter. You had mentioned earlier that there's equity in this bill. First of all, could you please tell me what that means and how does the governor's proposal show equity? If you could point out the points of equity in the bill, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. In fact, that's coming up in the next element of the presentation. There's $15 million set aside for equity projects, really to help serve nonprofits, communities of color that traditionally haven't been participating in the capital budget. And so there's a set aside that's been really important for the governor, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. It's not equity in the financial terms, it's equity as a society.
Well, thank you, Mr. Showalter. What does that mean?
Commissioner.
It means that there's many parts of our state that haven't participated, had projects located in their communities. And so the question is, how do we make this process work when general obligation bonds actually have fairly tight restrictions? They go to governmental entities. And as a result, you know, you see large institutions, but they don't necessarily always represent communities of color. And so how do we, within this bonding process, reflect more of the diversity of our community, more of the diversity of our state, and reflect some of the projects that's been going on for either institutions that serve communities of color or are run by communities of color. So that's where there's a $15 million in cash that's included in this recommendation, knowing full well that the bonding proceeds are a difficult tool to meet those needs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter.
Representative Davids, so last follow-up, and then we'll cover this in the next presentation. Representative Davids.
If there's a bonding project in Fillmore County, how does that meet any equity requirements? And number one. Number two, was the 2020 bonding bill equitable?
Commissioner Showalter, and then you can talk more about this in the next section of the presentation.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, great. I think the equity is, in fact, part of what the governor and lieutenant governor are serving up for debate in the legislature. As I'll note when we get to it, this is really a set aside for the legislature to see and discuss projects, whether they're in Fillmore County, in Dakota County, or any other county of the state. The bottom line here is, how do we serve different populations that aren't traditionally served by bonding bills? And that's part of the debate and part of the discussion that the governor and lieutenant governor are hoping to serve up.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Bertelsen. And I want to talk about procurement processes. Of course, procurement can be a great tool for ensuring quality and getting some established relationships in place, but it can also be very exclusionary in terms of making it harder for new entrants into an industry to gain opportunities. And this is particularly true for communities of color and women-owned businesses. So I'd like to know how the U of M is managing that. And I'm asking you specifically because both today and I think it was a couple of weeks ago, university's procurement processes were highlighted. So I would like to hear more. Thank you.
Mr. Bergeson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We certainly can are glad to provide maybe more data on this. I don't remember, won't have all the stats at my fingertips for that. But yes, we work with our Office of Equity and Diversity so that in our procurement processes, we set targets for ourselves for both percent of contractors and subcontractors who minority women may own majority owned businesses. as well as the percent of work, labor that is works on our projects. So we track and pay attention to who's leading those projects, what companies we're working with, and the people who are doing that work. In our processes, we continue to make sure we have an open ability for an open process for anyone to be able to bid. So though we have certain processes, I think they give us opportunity to manage the projects well, such as contractor, general contractor risk. Those are still open processes that allow people to bid on those sort of bid on those projects.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that they're open processes, but I've seen that open doesn't necessarily mean understood or that people are aware of them or know how to navigate them. And I'm curious what you're doing to go out and maybe recruit and share information about it. And just the last thing is that I would love a follow-up at a later date on more details. Thank you.
Mr. Bergeson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be glad to do that, and we'll work to get that information to you. I think, yes, we have our capital project design and delivery process has been working with our Office of Equity and Diversity to go out and meet with contractors and have held some sessions with kind of forums to make sure to better understand what contractors and businesses are out there and what challenges that they face working with the university. And so we are working hard to be out external facing and reaching out to the broader community to make sure that we can be a good partner and find companies to work with. So I appreciate your comment, and it is important that we not just respond, but proactively engage in those conversations.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a quick question for Mr. Showalter. I'm sorry I didn't have my pen ready. One of the very first points you made was the total deferred maintenance for the state. What was that number again?
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I ticked off several different numbers. For state agencies, deferred maintenance is $1.7 billion. Minnesota State also mentioned that they've got a deferred maintenance of $1.1 billion, and University of Minnesota, I believe, is at $2.15 billion. $1.7, $1.1, and $2.15.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Showalter. And then, Mr. I think the pronunciation of Mr. Golvin, regarding Capitol security and the fence that is around the Capitol, what is the future plan for that fence?
Mr. Given.
Given.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, Chris Given, Director of Facilities Management. The plan is eventually that for the temporary fence to come down when the Department of Public Safety and Department of Administration jointly believe that it's safe to take it down.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Lee and Mr. Given. So there's no plan to have a permanent fence around the Capitol.
Mr. Given.
Correct.
Representative Erdahl, at this point in time, no.
Thank you, Mr. Given.
Last follow-up, Mr. Erdahl, Representative
Erdahl. I would hope not. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative West, before we move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also glad to hear that there are not plans right now for a permanent fence. But I have two quick questions on procurement, as what Representative Ryer was talking about. So does that mean that the university would pay a higher cost for the same quality of the proposal if it went to a preferred group?
I believe this is directed at Mr. Bertelsen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, that's not our general plan. That is not how we operate. We don't, when we pick general contractors, cost is a significant portion of our selection process, but it's also about their experience in leading projects, their qualities, their professional, their team that they put together. So no, we don't have a cost plus process that allows to pay more just for that target.
Representative West.
Okay, so there is no premium that you stack up to make a proposal better if somebody's from a preferred class or something like that? I thought that was what the previous testifier was saying, but maybe I misheard.
Mr. Bergeson.
No, we don't have Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have a cost plus premium for that selection. We do work to make sure that we reach out to give everyone the best chance to apply for those kind of projects. It's about helping them make sure to put in their bid and understand the process. So, and give them to find the right kind of projects that they can both be best successful at. But no, we don't have we don't have a process that leads us to pay more for those kind of contracts.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeson. Thank you, Mr. Then next up, we will move on to housing infrastructure bonds, redevelopment appropriation bonds, and the equity piece of it. So first up, we have Commissioner Ho. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. It's a pleasure to be back in front of the committee. Since we did have a chance last month to discuss housing infrastructure bonds at length, I'll just be brief in my comments today. We are thrilled that the governor's proposal includes $100 million for the housing infrastructure appropriation bonds. This is a tool that Minnesota created, that you created back in 2012, that is the largest source of capital for Minnesota Housing to invest in housing preservation and new construction. They were created because the GEO bonds are really limited to housing that's publicly owned, and that's a very small part of all housing in Minnesota. The vast majority, 95% of housing in the state, is privately owned. And so these housing infrastructure bonds allow us to invest in the private owners and developers that do this important work. It also leverages an enormous amount of local, federal, and private investment. And so it creates development opportunities that otherwise wouldn't be there. We know that there's a great demand for housing infrastructure bonds because we see far more requests in our annual consolidated RFP process than we're able to say yes to. But housing infrastructure bonds, as we saw just last fall, allow us to say yes to more. Without housing infrastructure bonds, we say no to about 3 out of every 4 projects that come to us. With housing infrastructure bonds, I only need to say no to about 2 out of every 3 projects that come to us. Housing infrastructure bonds build permanent supportive housing for people with behavioral health needs, people who have long histories of homelessness. It helps us preserve federally assisted rental housing, which is so important because it allows us to keep those HUD project-based Section 8 dollars in our community, subsidizing rent for very low-income people. It helps us create housing for seniors. This is the one I love, age 55 and older. But really creates senior housing that's deeply affordable. New in 2018, it allows us to finance manufactured home community infrastructure, as well as a new use from October 2020 to develop single-family homes, building on work that we had done historically with community land trusts. So we are very excited about this proposal, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Let's proceed to Commissioner Grove first, and then we'll take questions. Commissioner Grove, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Grove, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And thank you for having me today to your committee. I'm here to cover off on a very important component of the governor's plan to rebuild Minneapolis and St. Paul in the wake of the civil unrest and the damage that was incurred following the murder of George Floyd. You know, really, one of the most important parts of our economic recovery is that we rebuild and recover these areas that were damaged in the unrest of last year. And it's not just because the business owners that were most affected by this unrest were predominantly Black and brown Minnesotans, who are the same population that have been more damaged by COVID-19 than any other in the state. But it's also important because this thriving, dense, urban commercial sectors provide a lot of tax base is going to be critical to really spurring the recovery of the entire Minnesota economy across our state. And then there's this, which is every single day, my team and myself, we talk to businesses who are thinking about growing here, thinking about moving here to create jobs. And one of the most important arguments for coming to any state is that you have a thriving urban core, not one that is filled with major corridors of destroyed buildings or infrastructure or undeveloped property. So we've got to rebuild these neighborhoods. There's no question about that. We've got to do it the right way, and we've got to do it for the sake of the entire state. So the governor's proposing bonding as a solution to move forward in this direction. It's $150 million investment in redevelopment appropriation bonds to really focus on rebuilding the small businesses and private property that were damaged in the civil unrest last year. Now, importantly, all the financing for this work would be run through the cities. They would then work directly with businesses and developers to rebuild these neighborhoods and some of these buildings. All of the rebuilding would have to have a public purpose. And that public purpose really is to increase the tax base and redevelop these areas and really focus on an enterprise development and wealth creation for people who are adversely affected by longstanding structural racial discrimination and poverty, and really to prevent the displacement of small business owners and the gentrification of these neighborhoods, which isn't something that any of us want to see. We want to return these neighborhoods to their cultural core and really get them thriving again for our state's economy. The debt service the state would pay for this $150 million in appropriation bonds is $10,364,000 per year, starting in fiscal year 22 annually until the debt has been repaid. That's about 20 years. And then importantly, there's some guidelines and guide rails built into this legislation to ensure that BIPOC communities are supported with these bonds. So for example, we want to make sure we're focusing on small businesses and economic opportunities for long-term residents. We're going to require that cities solicit community input and prioritize minority-owned or operated businesses. We want to prioritize and make it a goal to retain and rebuild impacted businesses and infrastructure in the entire area. And then accountability is key, of course. The state would require quarterly reporting on how it's going across all of those goals to make sure that state dollars are being spent wisely and that we're getting the maximum benefit in this rebuilding effort. So this is something that we've got to get right. As Commissioner Showalter said at the top, we believe bonding is a great way to do this given the current economic climate and the interest rates. And we think this is just a really key aspect of our economic recovery from the events in the last year. So I think with that, I'll turn it back over to my colleague, Commissioner Showalter, to talk more broadly about equity in this bonding bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Grove. Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. It's like to wrap up this portion of the second big element of the governor and lieutenant governor's proposal. The governor recommends $15 million to support capital projects from community-based organizations that are led by and serve communities of color and American Indians, as these organizations have not traditionally had access to capital investment from the state. As discussed in the previous Q&A, it's important to the governor and lieutenant governor that equity funding is always part of our bonding bill. These funds represent a set aside for the legislature to decide on. So it isn't a set of specific projects, it's a set aside that the legislature will look at and discuss after hearing specific projects this season. Just for context, members, you should know that there was a similar recommendation in the 2020 governor's recommendation. That was for about $30 million, and the legislature enacted $30 million for 13 equity projects. And so appreciate the chance to bring that before the committee, Mr. Chair, and that ends this segment of the presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Showalter. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Commissioner Ho. Good to see you again. Thanks for being here. I have been struck in your testimony before here and in housing, and again today, that you only have to say no to two out of the three projects that could be available. And my question is, it's great that we have the 100 million. If we had 200 million, could you then say yes to two out of three? And more importantly, would you be able to actually deploy that, or are you, is it the kind of thing where more funds isn't the barrier? There are other reasons that money couldn't be out into the community and getting into housing the housing pipeline as quickly as possible. I'm just trying to figure out the balance between, an abundance of riches and too much. Thank you.
Commissioner Ho.
Chair Lee and Representative Ryer, thank you for your question. You know, we don't have, housing capital is a finite resource. And we have a large hole. We have a lot of housing that needs to be created in Minnesota, and the gap is largest for people who make the least. The development process is long. And so for developers to begin crafting projects that fit within the housing infrastructure bonds, you know, they're kind of guessing whether or not these are going to be available in 18 months when I'm ready to go into Minnesota housing, or in, you know, next year when I'm ready to go into Minnesota housing. You know, what's great to signal to the development community is that we view housing as a priority and that we're going to make year-to-year investments in housing. And I have been fortunate during my short tenure to have received two housing infrastructure bond allocations from the legislature, and with this request, you know, potentially three in a row. That helps developers plan for the types of projects that these things build. And we need to be building year after year in order to get out of this shortage, which drives up the price of housing and leads to greater housing instability, especially for lower income Minnesotans. So I'm excited about this $100 million proposal. It matches the highest allocation of housing infrastructure bonds that you did last October. And it signals to the development community that we want to say yes to more projects.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. First of all, to Commissioner Grove, we've had a request for $300 million in bonding, appropriation bonds for the Minneapolis and St. Paul, now $150 million. I'm wondering, is there a damage total number of dollars that has been released, and what percent these appropriations would cover of that?
Commissioner Grove.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, it's a great question, and we're working closely with the cities on damage assessments. One of the things that we want to make sure we get right is ensure that there's no double dipping here, right? That if there's insurance money that can cover rebuilding, that the insurance money, in fact, does that, and that we're not putting bonding dollars on top of insurance dollars, or at least complementing that in the right way. So we would structure these such that the cities would need to take that into account when deploying the capital. Again, it really sort of depends on your insurance expense in terms of the overall amount that that has been damaged here. I think the cities are probably the best government institution to give the most accurate assessment of the damage. But in our conversations with them, these numbers very much line up with the amount of bonding we think we could very expeditiously and effectively deploy to begin this rebuilding process. And again, without it, many of these business owners, they won't rebuild. Like they're not going to rebuild just with some insurance money or even without it, because there's this first mover challenge, right? That if you're the first business to rebuild and you're surrounded by others who don't, you're facing a big challenge. So coming in this together in ways that are not certainly economically viable now, but bonding can make possible, is just really critical.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Grove. For Commissioner Showalter, my understanding is that you are talking about setting aside basically a categorical for equity funding, and I'm assuming that's for this one and for future bonding bills. Now, regarding equity, okay, if we have a category, that's easy to understand. Are we to be looking at all projects through the lens of equity, or how do we work around doing that?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great question, because, you know, I think certainly it would be the expectation and hope that equity shows up and is represented in all parts of the bonding bill. So it's not that there's one small part, $15 million for equity, and the rest isn't. That is, in fact, a value that's imbued throughout it. As Mike Bertelsen was talking about with the University of Minnesota, as other presenters have talked about, you know, equity should be and is part of the entire bill. That said, you need to make sure that we have the right financing for the right types of projects. And so that's part of the reason why Commissioner Ho and Commissioner Grove and I are talking about appropriation bonds for select needs that can be addressed by appropriation bonds. We've talked about general obligation bonds for other services and projects that need that can manage within those constraints. The equity projects that I'm talking about are cash. So those aren't bonding projects. They're building projects, they're capital projects, but they aren't bonding in the same way. And so that is a sort of a different category of this request.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Showalter, I think, you know, equity is certainly an important concern, but as I've said before to this committee, if, for example, when we are given requests from cities, like Minneapolis will give us a list of requests, we assume then that the entity making the request is doing this equity lens, because we deal with the requests that are coming from cities or counties or whatever it is. And I will say that in some areas of the state, like Fillmore County, equity is a whole different thing there in terms of the demographic makeup of the region. So it is reflected differently in the request that is made. So thank you.
And before I move on to Representative Lucero, just to that point, Representative Erdahl and I have shared this in committee already, that we have seen when some of these nonprofit organizations reach out to the local units of government to get their support to put in a request, that they have been turned away. And so I think that this is an opportunity for us to invest in these community-based organizations to serve all Minnesotans, especially those that are traditionally left out in the process. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my a couple remarks and questions. And the first is to Commissioner Grove. Commissioner Grove, you made some comments to the effect that rebuilding Minneapolis and in order to come to the state, it's we don't want to have a bunch of vacant buildings, and I completely agree with that. But the headlines that my constituents have been seeing for, you know, almost a year now have been a crime-ridden Minneapolis. Very dangerous carjackings, you know, multiple per day, gunshots, and just crime-ridden. And then the request is coming, and this is a direct result of the failure of leadership, of the call to defund police, the attacks on law enforcement. And so now there's a request for bonding to rebuild Minneapolis, to ask my constituents to send money to rebuild Minneapolis that's crime-ridden. My question for you is, what should I tell my constituents when they're asking the question, Eric, why should I pay for rebuilding Minneapolis that is infested with crime and there doesn't seem to be an interest in solving that at the Minneapolis council level? And the result of the buildings that were damaged is because Governor Walz failed to respond in the first place, right? He sat on his hands for days allowing the buildings to burn. Why should my taxpayers pay to rebuild that?
Commissioner Grove.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, certainly this is a challenging time for our whole state. And, you know, I think that questions regarding security of Minneapolis are probably best targeted at city leaders in Minneapolis than your Economic Development Commissioner. But I will say that as I look at the future of our state's economy and how we're going to rebuild it across Minnesota, we will not get there unless we rebuild these areas, and bonding is the best way to do it. I can't go out there and pitch businesses to come and grow and thrive in Thief River Falls or Roseau or Albert Lea or anywhere in the state without saying that we have the kind of state that can respond to crisis, that we have good government, can fix things when they're broken, and that we have thriving urban cores that provide a whole bunch of adjacent benefits to the rest of Minnesota. I think it's also just important to remember, at least as it relates to my department, we send far more money to help businesses grow and thrive in greater Minnesota than we do in the metro. For example, in the last year, we gave 834 economic development awards to greater Minnesota communities, 763 to the metro. We spend $103 million on growing businesses in businesses outside of the Seven County Metro, and $78 million on growing businesses inside the Seven County Metro area. And in terms of job retention and job growth, we saved over 5,100 jobs in Minnesota over the last year using economic development dollars. outside of the metro area compared to 2,700 inside the metro area. So I don't want to make this transactional and about pitting Greater Minnesota against the metro, but I think it's important to recognize that this governor's budget, in addition to looking after growing our state's urban center, which is critical for growth across the entire state, makes a whole host of investments in rural Minnesota too. And one example I'd bring up is broadband. If we have ever needed a reminder of how important it is to connect our entire state together and provide economic growth opportunities across Minnesota, we got it this year through the clear demonstration of the need for broadband to grow our economy at a time when we're all in forums like this versus in person. So $50 million in broadband is but one of many, many Greater Minnesota components to the governor's economic development plan, in addition to lots of carve-outs for Greater Minnesota. So I get the frustration. This is a challenging year. We think that in one Minnesota, we can come back and that the kind of taxes and economic growth we can get from building Minneapolis and St. Paul and these traditionally damaged areas that have been even more hurt by the unrest last year is an essential component of that recovery.
Representative Lissar, one last follow-up and then Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the commissioner, I didn't say anything about rural versus urban. I said failed leadership. And if you're equating failed leadership to urban areas, well, that's on you. My question is revolving around my constituents don't want to pay to rebuild buildings when there's a failure to have police and do something about solving crime. If we as taxpayers statewide send $150, $200, $300 million to rebuild buildings, but there isn't a solution to wanting to stop crime in Minneapolis, they're going to be burnt down again. And it's not unrest. It's criminals that are committing damage to property. That's not civil, and it's not something that we should tolerate. So again, I didn't get an answer to what I'm supposed to tell my constituents to rebuild buildings that they likely are going to be burned down again because of failed leadership. So, Mr. Chair, we saw we also heard comments regarding wanting to help small minority-owned businesses. I just saw a headline today in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Target's sales grew $15 billion last year, more than the previous 11 years combined. Do you know why Target sales, among other big businesses, increased so significantly? It's because of the shutdown of COVID by Governor Walz, the unnecessarily inflicting of pain disproportionately on small businesses. That's why these big retailers are thriving. The number one thing we can do to help small businesses, as a minority myself, as a business owner myself, get government out of the way, not trying to take money and redistribute it and thinking that's going to solve anything. Government is the problem. Big business is growing at the expense of small business because failed decisions like Governor Walz to shut small business down. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And to that point, you know, being a member from Minneapolis, I encourage you to come down and meet with me and my constituents. I do not see, you know, the crime-ridden responses that you are, you know, identifying right now. And, you know, we can debate this, you know, and we will have this opportunity to debate it and, you know, as members have in the Public Safety Committee. And I encourage you and all members of the committee to come down to North Minneapolis to talk to those businesses. As you have heard last month when they came and testified, and we will have this opportunity to debate this in the Workforce Development Committee on Friday too, where we're going to have a hearing on the appropriation bonds that I have, the bill that I have, and also the Promise Act that we have, you know, sent off the floor that the other body have decided not to support these small businesses that are crucial to the fabric of our state and, you know, our economic outlook going forward. And for members of this committee, you know, we can have this debate, and I encourage all of you to come and meet with the folks that are living through this every single day that we fail to do anything at the state level. Representative Frankie, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Chair Lee. I don't have any necessarily questions for any of the commissioners. I want to thank you. I want to thank the commissioners for coming out and giving us this presentation today. We'll have plenty of time to debate this. I do want to make a statement, and I want to offer up to all the commissioners, feel free to bring this back to the governor. You know, in all my committees, everything, you know, everything's wrapping around equity and equality. And I brought this up in other committees, and I really wish we would get back to including everyone. We speak about one Minnesota
Well, then let's include everyone. And when we're talking underrepresented communities, I found a section of law that I've been bringing to everybody's attention because I believe that there's other areas that we could also be addressing. Section 148E.010, it has definition in subdivision 20. Underrepresented communities means a group that is not represented in the majority with respect to race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, or physical ability. And I think sometimes we forget to bring in everybody else who's been underrepresented in our communities. And I would just ask that, you know, we put this forefront because that's going to be one of my big pushes is to keep this discussion going when we start to talk about One Minnesota, because we need to give everybody who hasn't had the full representation that we feel that hand and extend it out. So that's my statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Look forward to the discussion going forward. Thank you.
So since then, we have two hands up from Representative Davids and Moran. So Representative David, one question, and Representative Moran. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Maybe to Commissioner Showalter or Grove. I think we might want to take a reality check here because we know this proposal is going absolutely nowhere. Maybe Mr. Showalter, what's plan two? We know this isn't going anywhere. You know that. I know that. What's plan two?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, we're presenting it today, and I think the process of giving you the governor's budget recommendations is a necessary first step to the debate. You may come to that conclusion already. I certainly don't, and I would expect, just as the discussion today would suggest, that there's going to be lively debate on all of these proposals, and it's an important debate to have. And I think the governor has talked time and again that the budget isn't just a fiscal document, it's a values and a moral document as well. And this is the first step to addressing that as a state.
Well, thank you, Moran. Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Chair Moran, I'm recognizing Chair Moran.
This is not a moral.
Chair Moran, you're recognized, Chair Moran.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And good morning, everyone. I am feeling some tension from our colleagues as we speak about this One Minnesota that is inclusive of equity. That is what makes equity, that's what makes One Minnesota and equity aligns for those who's speaking of that. You know, historically, in this country, these are the communities that has been left out the foundation of America. We saw that through Jim Crow laws. We saw that through redlining and housing, home ownership, wealth creation. And so, you know, here we are today working with a governor who won based on trying to create a One Minnesota. And what I hear is a lot of division coming from the other side about being inclusive in how we make sure that we are maintaining an economic system that works for communities of color, that we have an educational system that is working for communities of color and our children and those outcomes, just as it should for anyone else across the state of Minnesota. And we can just go through all the other systems that represent who we are here in the state of Minnesota. So equity is not saying give us something additional, something more, but it is saying to see us and to value us and as a state invest in us. Also, Minneapolis and St. Paul are both beautiful cities, thriving cities with a diverse of members from all ethnic groups, which is the strength of who we are. And so for those who just see our cities as a place where you are scared and you are fearful, I would suggest that you spend more time in the city. Spend more time, you know, going out to eat somewhere as we're opening up our state. Spend some more time with diverse communities. Invest in that. Because in order to get to a One Minnesota, we have to be able to look at this word that we're using called equity and not see it as a negative, but seeing it as a way that we grow prosperity in Minnesota, across the state of Minnesota. And so as I feel my tension as a Black woman who and a Black legislator who seems to always constantly feel tension, I welcome you to my space so that we can move forward together. And that's it for me, Chair Lee, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Chair Moran. And so Representative Lillian Hewitt, we'll hold off on your remarks so that we can move on with the presentation and we can take them at the end. Next up, we have Mr. Dan Crum from the Department of Transportation on passenger rail.
Good morning, Chair Lee and committee members. My name is Dan Crum. I am the director of MnDOT's passenger rail program. I'd like to provide information on the $10 million bonding for the Twin City Milwaukee Chicago intercity passenger rail train included in the governor's bonding proposal. Just one quick update on what the project is. It's an additional round trip daily between the Twin Cities and Chicago to supplement the Empire Builder, which goes between Chicago and Portland and Seattle. We project 124,000 new riders between Chicago and the Twin Cities. A majority of these riders are for regional travel in the 400-mile corridor. In addition to passenger rail access, it also enhances the freight rail reliability and capacity to keep their products moving. It utilizes existing rail infrastructure and improves safety for the motoring public. And ensuring federal funds come to Minnesota, $10 million in GO bonding requests for passenger rail will leverage $44 million in federal funding through two federal rail administration grant programs. One is the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure and Safety Improvement Program, which is a national program that provides funding for intercity passenger rail capacity improvements and new service. That amount is $31.8 million of the $53 million capital project cost. And the second federal grant program is the Restoration and Enhancement Grant Program, which will provide up to 3 years of operating assistance for passenger rail service. And that can include lease payments on equipment, rail yard access costs, and so on. And that grant is for 3 years, and it's $12.6 million. To date, we've spent about $1.8 million on developing the project. Our project partners have included Wisconsin DOT, Illinois DOT, Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority, the La Crosse Area Planning Commission, and Amtrak. Specifically, the capital improvements in Minnesota amount to $40.6 million in the Winona and La Crosse area. In Winona, $19.3 million to extend sidings and update the platform improvements at Amtrak Winona Station, where currently people aboard the train on the main line. The Mississippi River Bridge Junction, at River Junction in La Crosse, is $20.8 million, and that would convert rail tracks to another main line to add capacity. And also would make improvements to the Mississippi River bridge crossing, which will improve speeds across that facility. And finally, $540 million to do the design work for a potential maintenance facility, light maintenance facility at the former Amtrak St. Paul station. That's the gist of the $10 million in bonding requests. Mr. Chair, thank you for the time. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crum. Next up, we have Commissioner Hickey from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Lee, committee members, Larry Hickey. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And today I'm speaking to you about the fourth and final state cemetery in Minnesota, which would be located in Redwood County. We're seeking $4.5 million in state funding to request to construct, furnish, and equip this final state veteran cemetery. We've We've received a letter of notification from the federal government that they're prepared to provide $5.99 million to be granted to the state of Minnesota for this state cemetery. The cemetery itself is located in Redwood County. It's 76 acres. The land itself is acquired by the Redwood County and is being donated in the process of being donated to the state of Minnesota. It directly abuts U.S. Highway 71, and the access to the site is through Nobles Avenue. And just as a matter of reference, in 2018, the legislature did provide $700,000 for the improvement of Nobles Avenue as a future access for the state cemetery at that location. In 2011, we were given a directive to create three additional state cemeteries in Minnesota. We've done that, completed the cemeteries in Duluth and Preston. This would be the final cemetery for Minnesota and would be added to Little Falls, which was currently operating prior to that. This cemetery would service over 22,000 veterans that are located within 75 miles. And we look at the burials per year once up and operating at about 300 burials per year. The design funding, again, was provided in 2011 by the legislature. We're using that right now. We're actually pre-design is complete, and we're in schematic design right now for the project itself. And with that, to Mr. Chair, if I can bring up Dave Swantek, and he'll tell us a little bit more about the need for the $4.5 million.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mrs. Swantek, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and committee members. My name is David Swantek. I'm the Deputy Director of Memorial Affairs for the Department of Veterans Affairs of the state of Minnesota. What we would use the additional state funds for this project fall into about four categories. Under architectural improvements, the funding would allow us to meet the requirements of SB, and that would include the installation of geothermal HVAC system, and also solar array for electrical needs of the property. In addition, we'd have added space for the honor guards that provide military honors at our veteran services that we have at our cemeteries, and also for some expanded space for maintenance operations at our cemeteries. Civil infrastructure areas that the funding would assist with is overall mass grading of the property. This property is essentially been a cash crop field near Redwood Falls. And as such, with this project, we would like to be able to grade the entire site and do some significant prairie restoration in areas that would be locations on this property. And then landscape infrastructure, the funding would allow us to install a sufficient irrigation system for overall landscape, turf, grass, trees, other plant beds, also buffer zones and perimeter fencing. This site is different than our other locations in Preston, Duluth, and Little Falls, and in the fact that it is an open field. And so we're looking for ways to kind of improve sight lines from properties that is creation of privacy for the veterans that you like. And then lastly would be dollars for overall project needs. Project went to the design phase of this project, and we're looking forward to being able to add this fourth and final cemetery, which is a culmination of the intent of the legislature going back now all the way to 2009. So with that, I'll pass this back over to President.
Thank you, Mrs. Swantek. We were having a little bit of issue hearing from you, and so if members, if you have any questions on his presentation, if we had time, we could take those up. If not, then I encourage members to follow up with Mr. Swantag and Commissioner Herkey as needed. Next up, we are moving on to parking ramp F, the upper suit deficiency and the bond sale expensive. We got Mr. Chris Given. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chris Given. I'm the Director of Facilities Management for the Department of Administration. I'll continue with another of admin's elements of Governor Walz's 2021 capital budget request. That element provides for temporary relief for the state parking fund by waiving the requirement to make a transfer of $1.1 million to the general fund in FY22. Suspending this transfer will help address the revenue shortfall in user finance parking, which is managed by the Department of Administration. This shortfall is a result of significant parking contract cancellations and decreased use of state parking meters because of the pandemic. Revenue reductions began during the state's work from home period and are continuing as employees continue to work remotely. In addition, since the public is not visiting the Capitol complex, parking meter revenue has been significantly reduced. The cost of funding is funded by users, meaning parking rates are set to cover expenses. This includes debt service expenses required by the legislature. Currently, the parking fund is paying the debt service for the Capitol Complex Ramp F, which was opened in 2015. It is a 530-stall parking ramp adjacent to the transportation building. Its construction was paid for with user finance bonds. Suspending user financing for 1 year would result in the general fund making the debt service payment for $1.1 million in FY22. The Capitol complex has seen a 25% decline in the number of parking contracts since the start of the pandemic, as well as a 75% decrease in parking meter revenue. Since the start of the pandemic, admin has worked to control the parking fund's expenses through salary reductions, postponing repairs and general maintenance, and minimizing overtime expenses associated with snow and ice control. But 40% of the fund's annual expenses are mandatory debt service payments. The temporary support that this will provide will help the parking fund continue to pay ongoing operating expenses while ensuring the debt service obligations are met. Mr. Chair, this concludes my testimony, and I will now give the podium to Commissioner Stroman from the Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Stroman, welcome back. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Sarah Stroman, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This next item for us, it's a small item. The governor is recommending $250,000 to defease the remaining state bond encumbrances on DNR facilities at Upper Sioux Agency State Park. And this is in order to provide some flexibility in planning for the future. There are really three critical factors leading to this recommendation. Number one, many facilities within the park are beyond their useful life, including the visitor center, several trail segments, and campground facilities. Secondly, the Upper Sioux community has a longstanding request to the state of Minnesota that land be transferred back to the Upper Sioux, given the extraordinary significance of this land to their community. And then third, and more recently, the failure of Highway 67, which bisects the park, has severely hampered access, both for our staff who need to service and maintain the park, as well as for visitors who wish to enjoy the park. MnDOT is in the process of examining the future of that highway, and currently they are recommending a reroute, which is a significant change in how we will be able to use and manage the park and how the public will be able to use the park. I will note that a decision on the ultimate future of the Upper Sioux Agency State Park will take some time. There are many factors that need to be addressed, but defeasing the bond encumbrances is a very helpful first step. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Showalter to discuss the bond sale expenses.
Thank you, Commissioner Showman. Welcome back, Commissioner Showalter. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. The final note here is that the governor also recommends $240,000 to cover expenses related to bond sales necessary to fund these projects that are included in the recommendations. This is just a necessary component of the $240 million general obligation bonding bill. So the last slide I want to give to Mr. Chair and members is a snapshot of the overall summary for this recommendation. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan recommend $518.3 million across all funding sources in their 2021 capital budget recommendation. This includes $240 million in GO bonds. That's the amount that's already included in the forecast. $278.3 million from other financing, which includes $150 million from redevelopment bonds, appropriation bonds, $100 million in housing infrastructure appropriation bonds, $15 million in equity-focused general fund cash investments, $13.3 million for other state agency cash investments. So that wraps up our presentation. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the chance to present the openness and willingness of the committee to hear my colleagues, and happy to take any additional questions from the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Quite the discussion today. I just need us to remember that I'm looking at a report here from 2010, and there's many more reports about disasters all over the state and how we respond to them and how we build on them. And not one place in this report was it said that we went after the mayor, we went after leadership because they did not put a flood retaining wall in when we told them to, or did they straighten a curve in a road where a truck rolls over, or did they do something about the train traffic that's coming through the area. I think we have to be real careful as we try to do things with, really, there is no report that I've seen on any root cause analysis of what happened in Minneapolis and who we blame for that. We're one Minnesota. We all are Minnesotans. And if something happens in your district, Representative Lucero, I'll be the first one to say we need to help them because you have a river in your district. You have a highway coming through your district. You have rail traffic, and you have a big mall there. That's what we do together, and we really got to look at that. Right now, our core cities who have a lot of revenue production for the state are in trouble, and we really got to look at that. And as far as diversity goes, God, I'm looking forward to this. I have the zoo in my district. It's going to be neat to see what lens they put on that as they're planning their bonding project. So I think we have to be really careful, take a step back, and just move into this and embrace our changes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Commissioner, I do have a question for you regarding some of the information that you presented at the very beginning with regards to our AAA rating. We have heard from testifiers earlier this session on the piece that now bond rating agencies are considering the impact of climate change to our ratings. And so can you speak a little bit to that now with what's been going on in Texas? How is that impacting what's going on nationally, and how would that figure into Minnesota as we move forward?
Mr. Chair, great question. You know, the back and forth between the state and rating agencies is something I appreciate the chance to come back to. Having been commissioner a number of years ago, I always learned that perspective, that national perspective, and you know, sort of rising issues from them. Climate change is certainly one of them. We haven't talked with them since being appointed. So that is a part that I am looking forward to learning, and I'm happy to come back to the committee and discuss that more. But certainly climate change, resistance, planning, capital infrastructure are all parts of the conversation, I think, that will be on the rise and is going to be part of this bonding discussion going forward.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lucero, since you are mentioned, I'll give you 30 seconds to make your remarks, and then we'll close it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hewitt and all members of the committee. If my city council or a supermajority of my council were to get up and publicly call to defund the police, which emboldens criminal thugs to continue a rampage and spiking crime, and then other people around the state are being asked to rebuild my city, I would say no. I would condemn my city council for taking such an irresponsible action. Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, have you condemned Minneapolis for attacking police?
Thank you for those remarks, Representative Lucero. And I do want to remind members of this committee that There has been an arrest report coming out from Minneapolis Police Department identifying that at least half of those members that were arrested are not from the city of Minneapolis, and they are from greater Minnesota and other parts of the country too. And so do know that this is an issue that is not just relating to the residents of Minneapolis. Thank you, Commissioner Showalter, and thank you to all the commissioners and testifiers for coming in today to present the governor's capital budget request. I look forward to having this ongoing conversation with all of you. And then members, next Thursday, or this Thursday coming up, March 4th, on the agenda is a growing list of number of modifications to previous bonding bills that we have heard from. And so this meeting is adjourned.